This week on Pop of Culture, a holiday stress-free zone. We'll hear music from Native American flute artist Larry Gindhart.
And we'll find a good book, or three, to get you through the new year. That's coming up on this encore edition of Pop of Culture.
Pop of Culture on IPR is made possible in part by Psi Iota Xi. Additional support comes from the Indiana Arts Commission, the Community Foundation of Randolph County, the National Endowment for the Arts, Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations, and sustaining members of IPR. You can support local programming today at indianapublicradio.org.
From IPR, this is Pop of Culture. I'm Jen Blackmer.
And I'm Michelle Kinsey. This week, we're listening back to some of our favorite interviews in Season 1, including Native American flute artist Larry Gindhart.
He joined us at the IPR studios in May, and he spoke to our co-host, Kara Duquette.
We are here today with Larry Gindhart. Larry is a Native American flute artist, percussionist, performer, an arts educator who specializes in transformative music for meditation, healing, and peace. Larry lives in Indianapolis, and he is the owner of Larry Gindhart Music and Larry Gindhart Photography. Thank you for being here today.
It's great. It's nice to see you. Nice to be here.
Wonderful. Can you tell us about your career and your creativity and a little bit about how those paths have intertwined and intersected throughout your artistic journey?
Well, I was an art major when I was in high school and at Ball State when I first attended here. As far as the artistic and musical side, musically, I was studying with African percussionists, African drummers from West Africa, and doing a lot with African percussion. I had the experience in the late 80s of hearing some music by a fellow named R. Carlos Nakai. He is a Ute and Navajo, or properly Diné, native person. And he's one of the preeminent Native American flute artists in the world. I heard his music and found that he was going to be at the Idlejord. So I went to hear him, and I was playing drums in those days. And I had the distinct impression after listening to this gorgeous music. He was touring. He's had two gold albums. One was Earth Spirit, and the other is Canyon Trilogy. And he was touring both of those albums across the country, and I think internationally as well. So he was at the Idlejord, and I got to go to his workshop and got to hear how he and his sound engineers produced Canyon Trilogy, and the music was so exquisitely beautiful. I was convinced I would never be able to play any music like that, and so I abandoned the entire idea. So I'd acquired a Rav Vast drum from Andrei Romanikov, who's in Perm, Siberia. And the instrument was in the key of B minor, Celtic. And I saw on YouTube somebody that was playing a native flute with a Rav drum. And so I thought, aha,
I'll
try this
point
out. Yeah. So I got a drum flute from Etsy. And it's really quite a beautiful flute. I still have it and still play it. But that's how I saw that I could play that with the Rav drum, but that was just the starting point. And so I became avidly intrigued by the native flute. And so years have passed, and here I am.
So from that point, you continued to learn how to play
through
exploration?
Yeah, all kinds of exploration. I'm a member of the Indiana Flute Circle, the Tree City Flute Circle. Both of those have very experienced players, people are playing flutes and guitar, keyboards, didgeridoos, all kinds of different instruments. And so we have jams once a month. And so we learn from each other and try new things out. And I have, through the years, have acquired a large collection of flutes in many different keys. These flutes are, the modern ones are made in pentatonic tunings. And into a particular key, like a B minor, C minor, D, E, F, you know, that sort of thing. So in the early days, a flute was made based on the length of the person's arm, like this, from the crook of the elbow to their fingertip. And so a handful at the top showed where the first sound hole would be, and 2 inches from there the second one, and then a hand grip, and then two and two and two and two, so that the measurements were all different. And so each one, it's called an indigenous tuning, and so each flute's different. So you can't really play with somebody else because they don't mesh.
So that flute that you were holding up, why does that fit you so perfectly from the crook of your arm?
Well, it just worked out that way, actually. This is, if you can see these holes right here, those are the tuning holes. So they go, they're right at the tip of my finger.
Now, what is that flute made from?
This is made from Indiana bamboo. We harvested it at a reserve near Corydon, Indiana, close to the Ohio River.
Very nice.
And a fellow named Joel DeLashmet, who we play concerts together, like at Mound State Park, and we play at nursing homes, and I think we're playing at Make Music Indy here in a couple of weeks. It's a citywide event that started in Paris, France, and is now worldwide, so we'll be participating in that.
Well, that sounds amazing. I would like to see that because I had the opportunity to hear you play in Mound State Park.
Oh, yeah.
And it was a beautiful sound bath. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, I play grateful to be able to play there every year. And we have a nice concert, and we give some flutes away when we can come up with a few extras. And it's well attended, and people are happy to be there, and we're certainly happy to be able to play.
Well, it was beautiful waves of sound that kind of came over the space and filled the air. So I'm wondering if you can play a little bit of flute for us now.
Okay. Well, I have several here, and I want to see what I'm feeling attracted to. So here I have. This is a flute made by Rick Heller, and it's made out of aromatic red eastern cedar. Beautiful. And it's in the Lakota style. It has five holes, and the air path chamber from the first section of the flute to the second is carved into this little block that sits on top of the flute.
And that makes this, it Lakota? Yeah,
this is a slow air chamber, so there's a wall right here. The flute, and the breath hits that wall and goes up over, outside of the body of the flute, underneath this thing. And they're either carved flat with a groove cut in the flute itself, like on, people can't see this, but the groove is cut here in the top of the actual flute itself.
Yeah,
and the groove is cut in the base of the block, which is probably more technical detail than we need to have for this interview. But
there's a cylinder, and basically there's a groove on the outer side.
Yes.
So if you can imagine that.
So here we go. There you go.
That was incredibly beautiful.
Thanks.
I understand that you have a couple of songs in the top 50 of top 100 on One World Music.
One World Music Radio. Yeah, right, it's the radio station in Europe that it is the top radio station for the genres that they cover, and Native American flute and piano and, you know, different kinds of instrumental and vocal music are offered on the stage. So I've got this last this month I have three in the top 50.
Oh, okay. I was wondering if you could share a little bit about your process with us, like how you create these
songs. The songs come from a really deep internal place. They're not. Since I'm right here, I'm doing all strictly improvisational music, and so that comes through me rather than as something that I think through carefully. I mean, I have certain structures, but all the songs are unique and don't often play the same one over and over again. So that was an improvised tune for this moment, and it's like the spirit of music that I am to express is there, and it comes through me. So I just, you know, it just guides me and guides how I think about the music and how it comes out.
Well, when you talk about that, it makes me want to ask you about music sound therapy. I know you do that.
Yeah, I have lots of Himalayan and crystal singing bowls and tuning forks and native flutes. And like if I'm doing a sound immersion, all of those instruments are involved, as well as some East Indian drone sounds and, you know, just different things that I decide to play as it's going along. And for those... For sound immersions, it's usually in a darkened room, and people are lying on yoga mats, and they go into pretty deep states of comfort and relaxation. If it's somebody that's got, you know, some kind of muscle pain problem, you know, that's just tuning forks, and it takes about 15 minutes to remedy the stress.
So the tuning forks, how does that work?
Well, in physics, everything is vibration. Mm-hmm. So we can only see things that are physical form because the vibration is slowed down enough that we can see it. But many physicists have said that the medicine of the future will be vibratory. And... You know, the concept behind, there's just, I don't know, I'm overwhelmed by so many things that I could potentially talk about. So I'll just say this.
Oh, that's okay.
If someone's having some kind of distress, and I'm not talking about cancer or any kind of thing, there's some vibratory work that's been done that's destroyed cancer cells and but not healthy cells, but that's in a real, real primitive state of exploration. So it doesn't exist for people to use at this point. However, if somebody's, you know, when one is in distress, usually there's a something that's out of balance. It's not in accordance with one's resonant state. And so certain vibrations and certain frequencies will help restore that. And everybody's had the experience of being around some kind of music or sound that is disturbing and upsetting. It could be somebody being stuck with a jackhammer on a street in a construction project.
Yeah.
Or someone with their car windows down and big amplification system that's making your car vibrate, and you're not really wanting to hear that music right now. That is an example. So once the music starts, there's just a return to one's resonant state, as a result of hearing the sound. And that's the best way I can say it for the moment.
Well, no, that's great. I want to ask you more. Are you always guided by your internal vibe?
Intuition or there's an old. Let's see, Frank Fool's Crow, Lakota medicine person, talked about becoming a hollow bone, so that the spirit can move through you, so that you don't have entanglements, ego, or things like that on the inside that taint or twist or distort what's coming through. So it's not to say that everybody can be a hollow bone, and certainly isn't. I'm not saying that I am a hollow bone, but that's a strive for, to make what comes through me as clean as possible. You know, I'm not a big deal. It comes through me, and I respect it, and I try to bring it forward. And so it's this, you know, it's the same with medicine, that it's not you so much doing it, it's coming through you.
Instrument of healing.
Yeah, like that.
Well, that's very beautiful.
Thanks.
Is there some other things you'd like to talk to us about in terms of your path?
Well, it's really an honor to be able to play these instruments. They're exquisitely beautiful. And, you know, I've had the opportunity to play for all kinds of, from kindergartners to, you know, people in their 90s and beyond. And to have that music be so well received and so appreciated, and for them to talk about the way that it benefits them, that's satisfying. And it lets me know that I'm, when I'm playing that way, I'm being a hollow bone best I'm able to.
Well, I know that you do play for many different groups of people, and I know you've done a lot of work, you and your wife, with children specifically. And is it possible for you to tell us the story of the first flute?
Oh, boy. Oh, I'm glad you brought that up. Making another bone reference. That's a bone of big contention. There are people that claim for the Lakota that the Shiotanka, which is the Lakota word for flute, which means great song, came about as a result of a young man being in love with a young woman, and although he was a very brave person, he was terrified of talking to this girl. And he'd been on buffalo hunts and had been quite successful and you know, when you're a teenage boy and you're dealing with a 2,000-3,000-pound animal trying to bring it down to provide for your family, it's pretty formidable. But he was great there, but when it came talking to girls, it was not good at all. So the girls in the camp there, the lodges were built in a big circle. There was a hill on one end of it, and the young girls would go down to the creek in the morning, collect water, and bring it up for, you know, the day's activities. And other young men would go down there, and they'd be talking to her, and she'd be laughing, and it'd be all cool. And he'd be standing off to the side, terrified and depressed. And he said that every night when he went to sleep, he dreamed about her and became more and more in love with every single night. And it wasn't going well. So he decided he was going to leave and disappear forever. And so he grabbed a little pouch of food and a bow and four arrows and started walking. And he shot an arrow into the air, and it just stayed suspended. And so he thought, I should follow that. And he did. And it came down next to a clear Cold Creek, and he spent the night there. And the next morning, he got up and shot another arrow into the air. Same story happened again and again. And on the fourth day, he lay down to sleep. And there was some rustling and weird noises in the bush. And these two men that were half elk and half man came out of the bush. And they said, "Don't be afraid. Don't be afraid. We are here to help you." And so one of them plucked a branch off a tree that a woodpecker had been working on and blew into it. And it made this beautiful sound. And he said, "I'm going to give this to you." And you learn to play it, and you go back and you play it for that young lady. And she will fall in love with you. So he thought, well, nothing else has worked. So he started walking back to his camp, and along the way, as is often the case with young indigenous people around the world who are learning to play instruments, he's listening to the sounds of birds and other creatures and trying to duplicate that on his flute. And so, you know, it could be... So he's hearing things and trying to play it. And after 4 days, he gets back there, and it's getting close to evening. It's at dusk, and he's standing on top of that hill. He starts playing the flute. Well, all the women in the camp come out of their lodges.
What's this?
Showing great interest in this sound. And indeed, the young woman did too, and she came out, and he went over to her, and she went back into her lodge, and she walked out with a blanket, which she put over his shoulders, which is the symbol that she accepts him for courtship. And so he was a happy young man, and they got married and had children and lived happily ever after, until, of course, the cavalry came, and that's a new story. and speaking of which, that's partly what happened to the native. Oh, I should say this: the bone of contention is that some of the elders, the Xiotanka Kaga, the old ones that made flutes. They thought this idea of the flute being a love flute was ludicrous. And so that story goes on, and it's a fun little story, but their contention is it's for healing, and it's for entertainment, and for the benefit of the people. And so that's the bone of contention. The Native American flute almost disappeared back in the day. Only old men, as with the Indian Wars and genocide and everything else going on, a lot of the old men got old and died, and only men played the Xiotanka. So the flute almost went into extinction. And in the early 1900s, there was a beginning of a resurgence, and Dr. Richard Payne, he became fascinated with the native flute. He was a physician, and so he started collecting flutes and talking to old men that knew how to make flutes and taught him how to make them, and he started teaching other people how to make them. And so by 1960, there was a resurgence of the Native American flute. And recall that Nakai came out with his gold, you know, gold albums. In Earth Spirit was released in 87, and Canyon Trilogy was released in 89, and they both went gold, and then Canyon Trilogy went platinum, and after like 2012 or something like that. So they came back, but they were almost gone. And I did want to say that you know, when the old men died that had flutes, the flutes were buried with them, and their possessions were burned, and then the you know, whatever was left was buried with them. And so I'm happy to say that some of the best flute players in the world now, Native American flute players, are women. And when we were in Europe last summer, I had the great privilege to play with Lisbeth Leroy, who's a prominent Native flute player living in the Netherlands. And so we got to spend the day with she and her husband at their home and play music and eat good food.
Now, how did women? How do you feel like women got into the flute?
Well,
arena.
They had to, like everything else women have to do, you know, they got to stand up and be strong and, you know, and push past all the pushback that they get for just being normal and creative and beautiful.
Okay. Well, can I be so bold as to ask you to play something else?
Sure. Which one would you like?
Oh.
So we've got I've got one in African mahogany, one in Spanish cedar.
Very difficult.
Got the giant sequoia.
How about the Spanish one?
Sure. This is a B minor flute. It's made by High Spirits.
Lovely.
They're based in Patagonia, Arizona. And it's a deep instrument, so it's really mellow. Spanish cedar.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
So, Larry, where can people find you and your music?
Well, I have a small collection of music on my website, larrygindhartmusic.com. I have a large collection on YouTube. Just YouTube and search Larry Gindhart and my channel will come up. I have a nice collection of music on Bandcamp.com. And all of that music is in high quality wave files. I've got some music videos at Vimeo.com as well.
Wonderful. Well, we've gotten really lucky. Larry's going to play another one.
This is made from giant sequoia. And it was, which is an endangered, protected wood. And it came from it's over 100 years old, and it came from a mansion that was being demolished east of Cincinnati. And some friends of mine went over and harvested the wood. Thank you.
thank you so much. It has been quite a pleasure to spend time with you and talk.
Back at you. Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Larry Gindhart is a Native American flute artist, percussionist, and arts educator. We spoke to him in May. This is Pop of Culture. I'm Michelle Kinsey.
And I'm Jen Blackmer. We're listening back to some of our favorite interviews this week, including our recent conversation with NPR Arts Desk reporter Andrew Limbong.
Even hardworking NPR journalists need a break from reality in their off hours. Many of them do that by getting lost in great books. And every year, they share their list of books we love. And we love that list. The full 2024 list is out. And here to talk about it is NPR's Arts Desk reporter and Book of the Day podcast host, Andrew Limbong. Andrew, thanks for joining us.
Hey, Michelle. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Let's jump right in. How many books do you usually get through in a year?
Listen, that's between me and my Google Doc. Or I think I go back and forth depending on, honestly, like how cranky my kid is being.
Yeah.
I think right now, as of this recording, I'm at like 53.
Wow.
Something like that, yeah.
That's 52 more than me this year. So, the Books We Love list covers such a wide range of genres and themes. How do you go about curating such a diverse selection each year?
Yeah, so what we do, for listeners who don't know, is that we sort of hit up all the staff at NPR, right? And so that's hosts, reporters, producers, mm-hmm. editors, engineers, our lawyers, anyone who wants to be involved, and ask them about some of their favorite reads this year.
Yeah.
And so what it is, it's like, it's not like a top 10 list. We kind of do year end a little differently. It's, I think there are like 350 titles on here. And then, so we compile all of that and then tag them into different categories to help people sort of filter out the stuff that they want to read and find mm-hmm. like the one book that would really, you know, endear them towards it.
Talk a little bit about those categories. What are you plugging them into that make the list unique?
There's the usual like biography mm-hmm. and nonfiction and like historical fiction and stuff like that. There is also the filter tag for staff picks. So if you want to like really specifically pick on, you know, stuff from us. And then my favorite category, you get are the rather long or rather short ones, you know, so you can like change which ones you what you're in the mood for. And what's great about this is that you can sort of stack them, right? So I just clicked on staff picks and now I'm clicking mm-hmm. on rather short, and now let's do what category are we into? Let's do like love and romance or whatever.
Love
and
it. We all need that. Yeah.
Yeah, and then we get this book called Nicked by M.T. Anderson. One of the producers for Weekend Edition recommended it. It is a like 11th century romp about like like maybe a stolen bones.
Oh.
You know? And so yeah, that's how you can find something that you might really be into.
I love that. And I also love like the staff picks where, you know, maybe you vibe with someone and so you're always going to look for their picks, right? Because you have a list.
Yeah. There is the stuff that I picked and like mm-hmm. that are tended more towards my tastes. Mm-hmm. One of the books that I shouted out this year was called Victim by Andrew Boriga. He's a debut novelist and it's about a young writer who comes from, you know, like an okay neighborhood, mm-hmm. but he sort of flubs his background a little bit to make it seem like it's a little harder and rougher than his background actually was. And then he finds himself in these circles where, you know, a bunch of white people are coming to him, like asking him to write like essays about race. And he's like, I don't know. And then he just ends up in these weird rooms, which I think is it's a funny sort of satirical take on the like literary industrial complex, if you will.
Yeah.
And so I just thought it was a really fun read.
Oh, that's awesome. So what does it take for you personally for a book to make the cut? Like, as far as like going that, it's one thing to kind of review or talk about a book, but then to recommend it to someone, what is it that that book, the magic that book has to have for you to recommend that?
So I have a, like, I have, you know, like, I think, like I mentioned, so I keep a running list of all the books that I've read, right? Mm-hmm. And like on that Google spreadsheet, and there's like a notes tab. And I think there's a correlation between how much I'm writing in that notes tab and how much I loved the book, right?
Oh.
If, you know, a book is mid and I don't really like vibe with it, I'm just going to write like, oh, it was fine. You know, the characters were cool or whatever.
Yeah.
But if there's a lot that I'm chewing on, or like, even if I don't maybe like, quote unquote, agree with what a book is saying, but, you know, it's just like something is clicking in my brain, that's definitely, you know, a sign that it's worth reading and thinking about.
Oh, I love that. What books are you looking forward to kind of cap off this year or maybe look forward to next year?
Oh, interesting. Let me look at my stack here.
First of all, how big is the stack right now on your
desk? My goodness, it's insane. I think it fell over the other day. let's see. Hang on. Let me take a look at this thing. I think I try to play catch up towards the end of the year during the holiday season. So there's a couple books from 2024 putting this list together that I didn't know about and that I hadn't read. One of them was it's a kid's book, so I'll probably read it with my kid. It's called The Lunar Boy by Jess and Sin Weboo. And it's a graphic novel by these two Indonesian authors, which I, you know, as an Indonesian American, I was like, oh, I didn't know we were out here like that.
Ah,
you know, yeah. I didn't know we were in it, dude. And so I might try to check that out. Also, you know, I like to end the year on like kind of easier reads. And so also on the 2024 Books We Love list was the Billy D. Williams, What Have We Here? It's his memoir. And it's also, it's like, you know what? You know, while the turkey's in the oven, I can crush that book.
Oh, nice. I love that idea. What were the biggest surprises for you in this year's list?
The biggest surprises?
Mm-hmm.
That's an interesting question. I think how many people responded to the Miranda July book All Fours kind of surprised me. Have you heard about this?
No, I haven't.
Miranda July, she's a pretty famous, she's like what they call in sports like a five-tool player, right? She's a visual artist and a writer. And she wrote this book about a woman who sort of leaves her family to go on a road trip, ends the road trip short, and has a bunch of like sexual escapades in the middle. And it's a journey of sort of self-discovery. There's a lot in it about like perimenopause and about how women see themselves as both like wanting desire and objects of desire, but also as like a person at the time. And I think it's a really interesting book. And I'm sort of like thinking about like why so many people responded to it.
Well, I just did because I wrote it down and now I'm going to go get it.
Nice.
I'm totally intrigued by it. Finally, is there a book, I think a lot of us have books that we love so much that we could read multiple times, and some people do. They like once a year they read, you know, a few of their favorite books. Are there any books like that for you?
I'm looking at my wall right now, and my copy of The Sun Also Rises by Ernest Hemingway is staring at me. I read that as I was like a sophomore in college, and it's a book that I return to like pretty regularly, and it's fun because, you know, I see all my notes in it from time to time, and you can see me sort of arguing with myself in the marginalia about like my opinions on what's going on and stuff like that.
Oh, I love that. I love that. And what would you tell someone who maybe hasn't dug into this Books We Love list before? What advice would you give them if they are discovering it for the first time?
Lean on the rather short tag. I love like a 90-minute movie, and I love a 150-page book. You know, just being able to say like you got a book in and you got it done, it feels so good.
Yeah, I love that. I love that. So there are all different ways you can get something out of the list. I love the way it's organized. I love the tabs. And I really need to do a better job of getting these books done on the list. But I thank you so much for doing the hard work for us.
No,
because I know
you.
There are a lot of listeners out there that appreciate it. Thank you so much for your time, Andrew. This was truly a pleasure.
Thanks so much. This was a lot of fun.
Andrew Limbong is a reporter for NPR's Arts Desk and the host of the Book of the Day podcast. The NPR Books We Love list is out now. We spoke to Andrew earlier this month.
Earlier this month, fused glass artist Madeline Heskett joined us to answer our favorite question, what are you working on? She sat down with Kara Duquette.
As we were sitting down, Madeline explained to us that fused glass is right in the middle between stained glass and blown glass. Except fused glass is baked in a kiln, like how you fire clay.
And then we can keep it very flat. It can have texture. We could fuse it a second time and slump it into a mold to create a bowl or a plate, something of that sort. So it has some shape to it, but not quite as three-dimensional as blown glass.
Okay, so when you say slump it into a mold, so that means it's melted, it's in a liquid form, and then you put it in a like a shape that becomes a bowl.
Yeah, so you would take a piece of, it is pottery, kind of like bisqueware, and we have to coat it so nothing sticks. And then if you have, say, a round piece of glass that's flat, you would set it on top of this round bowl shape, and you would fire it at a lower temperature so that it doesn't quite melt into a puddle, but it allows the glass to expand and fall into that shape and then kind of stay there. So,
wow.
Yeah.
Well, this is exciting. Can you talk a little bit about how you found this art form?
Yeah, so my Gram, I learned from her. She is a glass artist out in Tucson, Arizona. That's where I was born.
Shout out to Gram.
Yep. She has her own studio out there. And so when I would go visit as a child and teenager, I started learning how to do some of these techniques from her. And then I think about, it was when I was 18 or 19, I really started to show a big interest in it. So she started mailing me things. I would get boxes of random tools and scrap pieces of glass that I could play with and make wind chimes, things that didn't necessarily have to be fused. And then in 2021, I bought my own kiln and I worked with the Indiana Small Business Development Center to start my business Made by Madeline. So it's kind of been a slow progression, but I'm really excited to be where I am right now.
That's great. What all do you do with Made by Madeline?
I specialize in fused glass, both decorative as well as jewelry, and I make functional pieces. All of my glass is food safe, so you can actually use them as serving dishes if you'd like. But this year, I decided to start doing something new and offer classes. Ooh. So I'm partnering with the Culinary Cottage here in Muncie and offering a few classes this winter to do some holiday ornaments. And then we're going to do some more things in the spring.
That is a lot. That's wonderful. Can you tell us a little bit about, can you describe one of your pieces? Maybe one that's form and function, because I love that.
Sure. I think one of my favorite pieces that I did recently was a large Monstera leaf. This mold is what we would call a casting mold. So instead of cutting the glass to shape, I use the mold itself to shape the glass. You have to layer different powders or textures of what we call frit, which is like a ground up glass, like sand. Mm-hmm. And so I layer those colors in a way that will show the veining, but still let you kind of see through it. And then I fuse that. And after I pull that out, then I slumped that, like we were talking about, into a bowl shape. And it made a really beautiful centerpiece for a table. And so I think that's probably one of the bigger pieces I've made. It's about 14 inches in diameter. And I think it's beautiful when I look at it. So,
Now, what's the color palette of a Monstera leaf? Is it greens?
Yes, it is greens, but it was three different shades of green. And then I mixed the lighter green with black powder too, and then I sifted that into the veining so that you could kind of see that definition.
Wow. Well, do you make art every day?
I would like to.
Yeah.
I do work full time at Ball State University, so I don't have all day every day to create like I would love to, but I do work in my studio a couple evenings a week, and then I spend a lot of time on the weekends making things.
I feel like there's always, you always try to squeeze in more and more time to do.
Especially at the holidays. The holidays are the busiest time of year making Christmas ornaments. I'm up very late nights around Christmas time.
Now, have you had said that you're going to be teaching some classes at the Culinary Cottage. Have you taught before?
I have taught in other ways. Growing up, I danced competitively and I taught at a dance studio. I have led some greeting card making classes, but this year was the first time that I have started classes, and it was actually made possible by the Indiana Arts Commission. I am a 2024 fellow for their On-Ramp Creative Entrepreneur Accelerator program.
Wow.
So with their grant funding, I was able to buy the supplies I needed to start teaching classes.
Well, so do you feel like that opportunity has helped you to develop your artistic skills in certain ways?
Absolutely. I think that teaching is the final step in perfecting something, mm-hmm. And really kind of helps me hone in on the details a little bit more. And it also, because I tend to be a perfectionist, challenges me to be able to take a step back and appreciate things for the way that they are and all of their imperfections. And it's really fun. I think people are happy when they're creating, and they are pleasantly surprised when they make something beautiful.
Oh, I couldn't agree more. One of my favorite things is when people discover their creativity, especially when they're like, oh, I have none. That's just super exciting.
It is. And that's my one day goal, is to have a place similar in concept to Made in Muncie, you know, a paint your own pottery, but a fused glass place where folks can come and choose a project and sit down and create and come back and pick up later. So that's maybe my 10-year plan.
Oh, do it. Yeah. I feel there will be much interest in that.
Yeah, I think so.
Can you tell us where we can find you on social media?
Yes, I am on Facebook and Instagram, and both are Made by Madeline. Instagram is at MB Madeline, MBMADELYN.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. Thanks. I appreciate it.
It's time for the arts calendar. Let's see what's going on in and around the listening area.
So many things. Yes, let's talk about it.
So many. Calling all Swifties, what is being called the ultimate Taylor tribute is coming to the Gas City Performing Arts Center Friday, December 13th. The show, titled Fearless, celebrates all things Taylor, from the chart-topping hits to her iconic style. GasCityPAC.com is the place to go for more info.
Can't get enough Taylor, huh?
Not in this state.
Never. There are a few more weekends to catch Scrooge and Company in A Christmas Carol at Muncie Civic Theater. 288-PLAY is the number to call for info and tickets.
Also at Civic this weekend, Jen, in the Casaza Family Studio Theater is Prancer, based on the 80s classic Christmas film of the same name. This heartwarming tale of a Christmas miracle is sure to put the whole family in the holiday spirit.
It's a really cute play, too. It's good.
I haven't seen this one,
yes,
so I'm excited about it.
It's going to be great. Richmond Civic Theater is presenting It's a Wonderful Life, the musical, through December 22nd. Based on the beloved 1946 film, this musical faithfully follows George Bailey's life from his childhood dreams to his midlife disappointments and beyond, as we all take a journey to discover whether his life has mattered at all. Go rct.org has more info.
Light Up Daleville is 6 to 8 p.m. Friday, December 13th. Lots of activities and a very special visitor. No, not Santa. The Grinch.
Oh. Is the dog coming too?
I hope so.
I do too. Yeah, all right. Saturday and Sunday, December 14th and 15th, take the family on an amazing elf adventure at the Muncie Children's Museum. The Holiday Funhouse includes a scavenger hunt, activities, and much more.
The Yorktown Luminaria Festival is Saturday, December 14th. The all-day celebration beginning at noon includes a vendor fair, live entertainment, and so much more. And we hope your weekend is filled with celebrations. Do you have a celebration to share? Well, let us know at indianapublicradio.org/contact and then just select Pop of Culture.
Pop of Culture on IPR is made possible in part by Psi Iota Xi. Additional support comes from the Indiana Arts Commission, the Community Foundation of Randolph County, the National Endowment for the Arts, Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations, and sustaining members of IPR. You can support local programming today at indianapublicradio.org.
And that's our show. This special encore episode was produced by Luke Jones, whose favorite hiatus is a holiday hiatus, and was hosted by me, Jen Blackmer.
And me, Michelle Kinsey. Pop of Culture is a production of IPR on the campus of Ball State University.